Give ear to my prayer, O God, and do not hide yourself from my supplication. Attend to me and hear me. I am restless in my complaint, and I moan noisily because of the voice of the enemy, because of the oppression of the wicked. For they bring down trouble on me, and in wrath they hate me. My heart is pain within me. Terror of death falls upon me, fearfulness and trembling on me, so that I say, oh, that I had wings like a dove. I would fly away and be at rest. I would wander far off and remain in the wilderness, hasten my escape from the windy storm and tempest, for I've seen violence and strife in the city day and night upon its walls. Iniquity and trouble are also in its midst. Oppression and deceit do not depart from its streets. Wickedness is in their dwellings. Wickedness is among them. As for me, I will call on Jesus Christ, and he shall save me. When David was in the wilderness, sleeping on one side of a mountain, with Saul and his army on the other side of a mountain, he was kind of past the point of praying, oh, that I would go off to the wilderness and stay safe. There was no staying safe. Saul was chasing him everywhere. That's what we're going to see continuing on this week as we pick up where we left off, which is in chapter 24. The end of chapter 23, again, David's in the strongholds of En-Gedi, Saul has had to leave off because he's heard about the Philistines and how they're taking more and more land from the territories he's supposed to be preserving. At this point, they're encroaching on Dan, definitely, but into Asher and Naphtali, those areas as well. The Philistines are starting to take territory. David in En-Gedi, the wilderness of En-Gedi, the wilderness of Ziph, the wilderness of Maon, these are all the mountainous side of Judah, east of Jerusalem. So Jerusalem's in the mountains already, and this is like even more kind of the, when it talks about the strongholds, it's just hard to reach places. And that's where David has been and is as we pick up. And we're told, and I invite you to find your way, we're going to read some of this text here tonight. Chapter 24, it says, it happened when Saul had returned from following the Philistines that it was told him, saying, take note, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took 3,000 choice men from all Israel and went to seek David and his men on the rocks of the wild goats. So 3,000 men. David's got about 600 men with him. The women and children are probably not with them at this moment. There are times when that is the case. There are times when David is going to be concerned for his family. But at the moment, that doesn't seem to be the case. David and his men are living in a cave. This is not what you expect. When the prophet of Israel shows up to, you know, your house and ignores all your brothers and says, you're going to be king someday. And then the king who's king says, hey, come play music for me and fight my battles for me. Like, you don't expect to be sleeping in a cave 3 years later. And David is at this point in his early to mid 30s. He's anointed king at age 30. He will not become king until age 40, 10 years. 10 years of waiting, 10 years of watching the wicked do what the wicked do. And Saul, again, as a lesson, I have banged my head against Saul. I have been frustrated with this man. I have pitied him. I have asked why. I have argued with God when God says, why do you mourn for Saul? I've said, I don't know. I have a good reason, I'm sure. Right? But I am convinced of it now. And we're going to get it in the text today. Saul is the wicked. We're to learn this. Saul is the wicked. He is just a liar. There's really nothing true about him. And from the moment that he takes Samuel's job to offer sacrifices, thinking it must be some kind of magic, to the time when he goes to a witch, and does he see Samuel or not? We can argue about that later, but is pursuing magic. This guy has no faith in God whatsoever, ever. Even when he uses his name. And that's the kind of stunning thing about him, is he'll use his name sometimes. Saul will. So in any case, Saul, with 3,000 troops, he's a coward when they're looking for him in the baggage, but with 3,000 troops, he can chase a guy with 600 guys. And he goes off, and he gets exhausted. I won't take you all the way through the text, but this happens everywhere, right? And the way that the King James says it is very nice, that he went into this cave where David was in order to attend to his needs. The Hebrew, I think, is a little more explicit than that. It's very earthy, obviously. He's going to relieve himself in the cave. But there's these men that are staying there, and David's there with them. And I don't quite know how it would have looked, but obviously you can imagine it yourself. There he is around a rock, up against a corner, doing his thing against the wall. And David and his men are right there, and his men say to him, and we're going to get this again later, but they say to him, "This is it. Jesus meant for this moment, right now. He promised you were going to be king. He promised he would deliver all of your enemies into your hand. All you gotta do is reach out and grab it. All you gotta do is reach out and take it." And David's response is so edifying. And by that I mean it is inspiring, it is wise, it is good on such a deep level. And so what he says is he's not going to do it. Let's see if I can find the text here where he speaks. Verse 6, he says, "Jesus, the Lord, forbid that I should do this thing to my master," to Yahweh's Messiah, right? God's Christ, "to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the Messiah," that's anointed there, Messiah, the Christ of God, the Christ of Jesus. The king who Jesus sent before Jesus sent himself. So David restrained his servants. Notice David's chief concern is that Saul is in fact king because God said so. And even though God has promised to David that David will be king, God has never said, "Do it yourself." And David, if we're going to learn anything from him, along with his humility, that he just trusts God, this guy reads his Bible. He really does. He's read about Abraham. I mean, he knows how this story goes. He knows how when Abraham has the covenant promise, and then his wife says to him, "Take my servant Hagar," that this is not really what God wanted to have happen. But that if Abraham had simply waited on God, that the covenant would have been fulfilled in time anyway, as it surely was. David's read that. And I'm not saying that's what he was thinking, but I'm saying it's the same wisdom. The heart of David already has it. And now his life's just going to give it to us again as he speaks. Why would he ever raise his hand against anything God has said? This is going to be here until I move it. So even though he has the chance, he says, "No, I won't do it." And then, after this, they come out and they go out of the cave, and Saul doesn't even know what's happened. David calls him. In verse 9, David has this marvelous defense, imprecation a little bit. He actually prays to Jesus against Saul in Saul's hearing. I mean, it really is quite the statement to say to someone, and yet it is also like his legal defense. And he's going to throw himself on the mercy of Jesus in front of Saul. It's really something. So he says, "My lord the king," and Saul turned and looked behind, verse 9, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Indeed, David seeks your harm'?" You spend time in the Psalms. One of the lines says, "What can man do to me?" And the next line says, "All day they twist my words." Their thoughts are against me for evil, right? David knew this all too well. It isn't just that Saul has this wicked spirit attending him, but clearly there's political opposition to him in the court. He's having to hear about it all the time. "Why? Why do you listen to them, Saul? No? Look, this day your eyes have seen that Jesus delivered you this day into my hand in the cave, and someone urged me to kill you, but my eyes spared you. And I said, 'I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is Yahweh's Messiah.' Moreover, my father," he calls him his father. This isn't just buttering him up. This is the righteous role of the king in society. He's appealing to the man in his office. Yeah. "My father, yes, see the corner of your robe in my hand. For in that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, know and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand. nor have I sinned against you, right? So look, proof, I could kill you. I didn't do it. I don't want to do it. Yet you hunt me to take my life. Now here's the imprecation. He's going to pray to Jesus in front of Saul for vengeance against Saul before he asks for mercy. Let Jesus judge between you and me, and let Jesus avenge me on you. But my hand shall not be against you. Love your neighbor as yourself, like in practice right there. As the proverb of the ancient says, notice he not only reads the Bible, or well, maybe this is from the Old Testament. I couldn't find a place of a direct reference to this. You know, wickedness proceeds from the wicked. But he has, again, knowledge of the ancients. He studies. He cares about what's been said before. So here he quotes a proverb, right? As the proverb of the ancients says, wickedness proceeds from the wicked, but my hand shall not be against you. That's a very clear statement if you take the two together. He just called Saul wicked for us. He just said, you're wicked, and you're going to be wicked, but I won't be wicked. It's quite a thing to say. And verse 14, he pleads humility. After whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom do you pursue? A dead dog? A flea? Therefore, let Jesus be judged and judge between you and me, and see and plead my case and deliver me out of my hands. So like at that point, again, I've prayed to Jesus that Jesus will destroy you. What am I anyway? I'm a flea. And so I pray to Jesus, save me from him. And you know, this whole thing, they're 10 feet away from each other outside the cave. David finishes on the ground. No, really, I mean, Saul could take his sword, could take some men, order to kill, attack. They're in the cave, they're trapped. What a foolish thing for David to do, unless Jesus actually answers prayers for mercy, right? In which case, this is like Hezekiah before Hezekiah, like face to face. There's Rabshakeh and Hezekiah sitting right there, right? Who will you call on? And it gets to Saul. It's so beautiful. When David was finished, Saul says, is that your voice? My son, David, he's such a liar though. But he's probably hurt. These are crocodile tears. It matters, but it won't later. He'll change his mind. That's the problem. You are more righteous than I. You've rewarded me with good, whereas I have rewarded you with evil. You've shown this day, you've dealt well with me. For when Jesus delivered me into your hand, you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safely? Again, love your neighbor, love your enemy. The wisdom of the Bible. It doesn't mean let evil men do evil at all times. It doesn't mean that, right? Turn the other cheek doesn't mean all evil just gets to do what it wants. Yeah, but we always seek to be righteous in our place, in our place. And particularly when you're dealing with Jesus is Christ, Saul, the king, like the only one who gets to remove him is God. And so David knows that, right? In any case, back to Saul again. Therefore, may Jesus reward you with good for what you have done to me today. Does he mean that prayer? Maybe for the moment. And I know indeed that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Therefore, swear to me by Jesus, you will not cut off my descendants after me, nor destroy my name from my father's house. Which is interesting because God's already kind of said he's going to cut off Saul's descendants, right? So Saul, immediately, he's going to use Jesus' name to try to get something for himself, which is against what he's been told he's going to get in the first place. So Saul continues to be wicked, even as he gets broken by the moment of mercy. It reminds me of Jacob and Esau, too, where Jacob limps over Peniel and, you know, falls before Esau, and Esau's there with 400 men to kill him, I think, and he can't. He can't. The plea for mercy works. It's not just a tactic, but a bit of truth. It's going to happen again in chapter 26. We're going to skip chapter 25 for a moment. Look at chapter 26. And see, the same thing happens, only now there's a Saul's army is camped together, and David is able to sneak into the middle of the camp, steal Saul's spear and water jug, I believe, from beside Saul and Abner, Saul's general, and get out of the camp. And then he's going to do the same thing. We're going to look at the conversation where this begins. Verse 13 of chapter 26, David went over to the other side and stood on the top of the hill afar off, a great distance being between them. And David called out to the people and to Abner, the son of Ner, do not answer, Abner. Abner answered,
"Who are you calling out to the king?" David said, I love this, "Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel?" Right, both of those things are supposed to be good, but then, "Why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For one of the people came in to destroy your lord the king. This thing that you have done is not good." So he's like accusing the general of treason, basically, because everybody was asleep in the camp. "As Jesus Christ lives, you deserve to die because you have not guarded your master, Christ's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is and the jug of water is." But now Saul comes back. "Is that you, my son, David?" No, he breaks down. This man, he's just kind of mad a little bit. David said, "It is my voice, my lord, O king. Why does my lord pursue his servant? For what have I done, or what evil is in my hand? Now, therefore, please let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If Jesus has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. But if it is the children of men, may they be cursed before Jesus, for they have driven me out this day from sharing in the inheritance of Jesus, saying, 'Go serve other gods.' So now do not let my blood fall to the earth before the face of Jesus. For the king of Israel has come out to seek a flea, as when one hunts a partridge in the mountains." Saul said, "I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will harm you no more, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Indeed, I have played the fool." That's kasil in the Hebrew. It's the standard word. Kasil. It's the standard word, sakal. It is a standard word for fool. "I have played the fool and erred exceedingly." David answered and said, "Here's the spear. Your life was valuable." And on, David does not go back with Saul. He'll remain in the wilderness and then leave, as we're going to see in chapter 27. But there's this moment again where Saul's willing to give peace. What I want you to see most, though, is the heart of David and how he makes these statements. Not only, what have I done? He tells the truth. No, I haven't done any evil. I hear my words. He calls on Jesus. If I did something against God, I broke the laws of God, that means that the police should come and get me. That's kind of the real reality there. Then let me do something. Let me fix it. Let me make up for it, right? What do I have to do in order to get you to acknowledge my sin is forgiven before Yahweh? Let's do that. What that is an appeal to Torah. Again, you see, every time David's talking, he knows his Bible. He's using his Bible. Jesus will accept an offering. And if it's men who are lying about me to you, well, Jesus is going to curse them. He says that as well there too. But do not let my blood fall to the earth. In between these two stories is the story of Nabal and Abigail. This is the story of David's men in the wilderness having something to do in keeping the roads and the areas free from raiders and thieves. Raiders often being the Amalekites, the Moabites, the Midianites, people from the south, the Ammonites also from the east. David and his men will protect much of the area that Saul should be protecting and is not, including the area around Hebron, which is a little bit northwest of Jerusalem, and it's where everything in the Promised Land starts and centers. Even Ramah and Gibeah, which Saul is from, they're close to Hebron compared to, say, where David is down in En-Gedi. It's down in that, it's up in the Hebron region that David is protecting from the Philistines, also raiding from the west. And over the course of a year plus, he has done the work of keeping the region safe from bandits. So there's going to be an annual celebration. There always is, for both sacrifices and for the harvest. And there's going to be a lot of food that's going to be given to everybody who's part of this area because they all work together to make it work. It's not solo farming. And there's a guy there who's got this huge, huge plantation group that David's been protecting. His name, again, is Nabal. One of the most interesting things about Nabal to me, aside from that his name is Fool, and who named their kid that? Sorry, we weren't thinking that one through. But he's descended quite well. He's descended from Caleb. And again, Hebron, this is like choice territory in the land. This is a rich, inherited man. And he's got lots and lots coming in this time of year to give. And David sends some men to ask, can we please have some food? We've not been bandits, and we could have been. We have protected you anyway. Nabal won't take it. He said, no way. Who are you? Who is David? He sends back an insulting message. And this gets David a bit upset, and perhaps rightly so. I don't want to hasten through this too much, but I am conscious of our time. But this is a massive wisdom moment here, where David doesn't do a Bathsheba, but he's about to. And kind of worse, Bathsheba's commandment 6, this is commandment 5, murder. He's about to go murder every man, woman, and child in the place, all because he didn't get fed. And Abigail, the wife of this man, she hears what happened, and she meets him and his 600 men coming to destroy the town on the road with a bunch of food. And I want you to hear what she says, too, because she has the same kind of heart of wisdom, where she pleads mercy mixed with wisdom all the way through it. So this is back in chapter 25. She says, turn one page for me. She says in verse 24 of chapter 25, on me, my Lord, on me let this iniquity be. And please let your maidservant speak in your ears and hear the words of your maidservant. Please let not my Lord regard this scoundrel, that's son of Baal, Nabal. And so the Hebrews, scoundrel, son of Baal, fool, Nabal. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal, that's fool, is his name, and Nabalim, that's folly, is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now, therefore, my Lord, as Jesus lives and as your soul lives, since Jesus has held you back from coming to bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek harm for my Lord be as Nabal. And now this present which your maidservant has brought to my Lord, let it be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant, for Jesus will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord fights the battles of Jesus, and evil is not found in you throughout your days. Yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life, but the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with Jesus your God, and the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the pocket of a sling. And it shall come to pass, when Jesus has done for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you ruler over Israel, that this will be no grief to you nor offense of heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause or that my Lord has avenged himself. Like, that whole thing was to get to that last sentence there. I mean, there's one more sentence, but that last bit, she basically says all of that so that after you've been successful and you've come into your kingdom and everything is growing great, you won't look back and regret that you killed a bunch of innocent people today. So blame me, she says, right? Blame me. Don't kill them. And when Jesus has dealt well with my Lord, remember your maidservant, right? Remember me when you come into your kingdom, I think is how the thief said it to our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, David will rejoice at what she says and thank her, basically for saving his soul. Don't think salvation, think conscience. He was going to be burdened and possibly punished by Jesus for this. And she stopped it. Nabal will receive his punishment. She goes home. He's in the midst of a big party, drunk. She decides to let him sleep it off before she tells him she paid all his money to the guy he thinks is an idiot. And she tells him the next morning he's struck kind of dumb. You know, he's just struck by it, but nothing happens for 10 days, and then he dies. When David hears that Nabal is dead, he immediately sends for this woman who had to be a little bit of an older woman. I mean, can I jump us forward to Bathsheba for a moment? Bathsheba time, we're looking at David's in his 50s or 60s, and maybe Abigail's in her 70s, right? 80s even, right? This is an older woman that he's taking into his roof as sort of a redemptive moment, but also recognizing her faith particularly. Her faith, her trust in Christ. She says, remember me, take care of me. Her husband dies. He will, and he does, and he inherits Hebron, which he then begins to rule from, right, shortly after this, as that goes. He will also take Ahinoam, a woman from Jezreel, She is from the northern area where, again, the Philistines are trying to encroach. It would be Dan, it would be Asher, but it just eventually gets called Jezreel, the Valley of Jezreel. Two wives, we don't have time to talk about that tonight, but it's David read Torah, and he must have just skipped that verse or blocked it out or not looked at it, but there's a section in Deuteronomy about if you're a king, it's not about how you can't have two wives, it's about how if you're a king, you can't have two wives. We can talk about two wives as a bad idea, but it was more specific for David. It's very clear. And he doesn't pay attention to this one. And it will be where the sin of Bathsheba will come in a bit later. But from here, then, and with just a few moments to kind of close the story up with the text you heard read already, now you know why David's like, this guy Saul, he's never going to leave me alone. He's never going to leave me alone. I got to get out of here. I'm tired of running around these mountains and these woods. Maybe if I go to our enemies, Saul won't go there. So he goes to Gath. This is where Goliath is from. You know, this is the heart of the Philistine encroachment upon the land. And he goes with his 600 men. I'm surprised the king of Gath doesn't kill him on sight. You know, David's slain his tens of thousands. Right? He'd already acted mad once before. This is probably the guy's son. But in any case, David convinces him that he is being persecuted, he's no longer welcome, and he's going to serve him. And he begins to do so effectively in the southern area, where there are many towns of Judah that he claims to be raiding on behalf of the Philistines and bringing loot, tribute, back to Achish, this king of Gath. But he's not actually doing that. David's not doing that. What he's doing instead is going a little further south to the Amalekites and a couple other groups that's mentioned in the text that are smaller groups. All of them. Camel riding, Bedouin herdsmen and raiders, right? They're going to come in, they're going to eat your stuff, they're going to leave. He goes out against them, takes their gold and silver, brings it back to Achish. And then Achish trusts him as a result. So now he's living there with the 600 men and all the women and children. And my guess is, since he's like a double agent at this point, I mean, he's a spy's spy, like he can't trust anybody, that I totally understand where he's like, I need to live in a different city. I don't want to live here. And so his move to get Achish to give him Ziklag makes a lot of sense too. Why would Achish want a guy descended from his enemies with 600 armed men living in his town all the time, even if he trusted them? Ziklag is down and into Judah, and it kind of begins a big part of this story, which is David's work to take the land that either Joshua failed to take or that had been lost since Joshua's time. So Judah taking Ziklag, kind of in the territory of Simeon, actually, if you think about where Simeon's cities were, is a beginning of David's role to fulfill the taking back of the land and the finishing of the settling that was incomplete and then broken under Joshua. Saul also, by the way, was called to do that and did so in one key battle going against the Ammonites. But of course, that's when he offers the sacrifice and a bunch of other stuff goes wrong. So David's up and in hiding. He's got this town where his family can live, and we leave him there for next week. I didn't say a lot about Jesus tonight, and I think you have plenty of trust in our Lord Jesus Christ to put him into the story where he is God, but to also see how David is a picture of him, rejected by those who should receive him, driven out, whereas he should have been brought in, right? And all that persecution and suffering leading to ultimately his death on the cross on our behalf. So there's that. This is the history of this as well. But I think most of all, why are we looking at David? We're looking at David because his heart is one which sees that it needs God. He needs Jesus. And when he has the words of eternal life, he's just not going to go anywhere else. And I think in our age where most heroes are either all good or all bad or falling apart or anything but the Bible, to remember these men of faith of the old and how they stood against very real times with nothing but trust in Jesus Christ. And that is an inspiration to us in these gray and latter days to know that the one who sent the Spirit then sends the Spirit now. And again, we don't just have one anointed one. All baptized Christians are anointed in his name.